Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we have Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Ben Robinson, author of Beer Hacks, Tips and Tricks, Serving, Sharing, Savoring, and More, projects as well. Later in the program, I'll be speaking with Meredith Oakes about her recent book, Rock and Roll Woman, The 50 Fiercest Female Rockers. First, we have Lillian Vasquez and some theater in our region.
My guest is Murray Heppner. She is the producer with Main Street Theater Company at the Lewis Family Playhouse in Rancho Cucamonga. Welcome.
Thank you.
So for those of us that may not know much about Main Street Theater Company, share a little bit about what it is, and then we'll talk about your upcoming production.
So the Main Street Theater Company is the professional theater for young audiences company at the Lewis Family Playhouse. We're an equity theater company, and what we do is plays and musicals geared for young people, so kids as young as four, and we do shows usually up to middle school.
And give me an example of some of the shows you've done in the past. Off the top of my head, I remember there was a baseball movie about a baseball card is what it really was. So share some of the productions that have gone on that you've been involved in.
Yeah, so we've been around for 12 years. This is our 12th season. Earlier this season, we did a production of Roald Dahl's The Witches, which is perfect for Halloween. But every year we do three shows for different ages. So this season, we're also doing a musical called Frederick for kids as young as four. And last year we did The Secret Garden, but we also did Stuart Little for the younger kids and a musical of Goldilocks and the Three Bears.
That's so great that you picked that audience to perform for, because it invites children at a much younger age into the theater and to get involved and see productions right in front of them on the stage. Tell me a little bit about the experience that some of the children have shared with you.
The kids are so great. The best thing about doing shows for young people is that they are the most honest audience. So you get the reaction. No, but it's good. So you know that you're doing it right when they're laughing, they're having a great time. We do performances for school groups during the week that kids come on field trips, as well as our public performances. And on those field trips days, we do question and answer sessions afterwards. So the kids are engaged. They ask questions about the production. They want to learn about the lighting and the scenery and how things move. It's fabulous. The actors love hearing immediate responses from the kids.
And I would think that, you know, you never know who's in your audience and what they're being influenced by, what's on stage, and if that changes their thoughts of, oh, I want to do that, and how they can get involved. So I love that you entertain a young audience and expose them to the arts very early.
Yeah, and not only do we expose them to the arts, but I think part of our mission is to expose them to new ideas. So the arts are such a wonderful way to talk about things that you might not talk about in other ways. And so I'm always trying to find stories to share with them that might make them think a little differently than they would if they're just watching TV or going to the mall or something.
And then do you ever have experiences at your location where maybe they learn to do some writing or blocking or learn more about the theater, the back end of it, even though they may not be performers, but they might learn or be exposed to a little more theater? Is that ever something that goes on?
The theater itself, not Main Street Theater Company, but the Lewis Family Playhouse does have some after-school classes that are really tied to the community theater program there. And so we do have kids who come and learn about singing and dancing and who work in our community theater. But Main Street is our professional company. And so what we do is show them how it's done.
Nice.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about the audition process. If it's a professional company, in essence, then there must be an audition process for you to choose your actors. Does that mean they're paid if it's professional?
Yes, absolutely. They're union artists. So we have auditions for every show 3 times a year. We send out notices. The agents and the actors submit their pictures and resumes. I go through them, and we get hundreds of people submitting. It's not—
Really?
Yes. And so then we kind of narrow that down, and the directors, depending on if it's a musical or not, director, musical director, and I will sit for a couple of days and audition people. And then we have callbacks, and then they're chosen. So it's a long process, actually, and we're very lucky. We've been around now long enough that the artistic community in the Los Angeles area really loves working for us. And so we get a lot of wonderful, wonderful performers who come and share their art with the kids in the community.
So that was my next question. Do some of the performers come from our Inland Empire region, or are they coming from the LA region?
I would say mostly from LA or Orange County. That's where most of the professional actors live, because that's kind of where the work is. So they all commute out to Rancho Cucamonga and do our shows.
So when you do a show, you do the audition, you cast your company, and then rehearsals. How long are rehearsals before you go on stage or go live with your audience?
Rehearsals are pretty fast. We rehearse for about 2 weeks, and that's it. We rehearse for 2 weeks in the rehearsal room, and then we have what we call technical rehearsals, where we rehearse for 12-hour days. Then the next day, we have an invited dress rehearsal. And then we start doing shows for kids in the morning. So it's very, very fast. They work 6-hour days, 6 days a week for 2 weeks.
So they work 6-hour days because I'm guessing that some of the characters in your company are going to be kids and they can only work so many hours. Is that the case or no?
No, all of the actors are adults. And of course, all of our shows, because they're based for kids, have child protagonists, but they're all played by adult professional actors.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, let's talk about your upcoming production that you're involved with. The official name is Oh Freedom, the story of the Underground Railroad. Tell me about the show and what it's about.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this one. Most of our shows are based on children's literature, but this play is really just based on history. And it was written by a guy named Peter Manos, who teaches in Ohio at a university, is a historian. And it's a documentary-style show about the Underground Railroad. So it takes history and it brings it to life. And we're really excited to be doing this for our older young people. So it's geared for fifth grade and up, 10 years old and up. And it tells the story of a lot of different people in history who were involved in the Underground Railroad. And what's cool about it is that it's a hard subject to talk about slavery and what happened in the 1850s in our country. But what this play really does is it teaches, I hope, young people about resistance. It talks about a time in our history where people of different backgrounds and values came together to do something that was morally right, even though the law said that slavery was the right thing. And so I'm excited to be doing this play now for young people because they need to understand our history. And it always, of course, when you see history live on stage, it makes you think about today. And I hope it will make them think about that.
I'm speaking with Marie Heppner, who is the producer of Main Street Theater Company, and their upcoming production will be Oh Freedom, the story of the Underground Railroad. When you do something, have you done something like this? Was it a book and it's already been written into a play form, or did you guys do that yourself and make it into the play form? How was that process?
We did not turn this into a play. This play is published by a company called Dramatic Publishing. We are doing the first professional production of it. It's been done in mostly the South, touring to schools. So very simply it's a cast of four actors who sing. We're putting it up on the Lewis Family Playhouse stage, which is a big 40-foot proscenium, 550-seat theater. So we're actually doing the first professional production of it, but it's been around for about a year, and it's done really well with junior high groups, mostly in touring to various schools.
You mentioned that much of your performances are geared for a younger audience, and you listed them like Stuart Little and some of the others. How do you go about choosing what you're going to do? You indicated that you do about three a year. So do you have your lineup for the next 5 years, or what comes to you? How do the ideas come to you?
Yeah, it's a very interesting process. I do it in a lot of different ways. So I read a lot of plays all the time. I'm always reading plays that other companies have done. Because we are owned and operated by a city, our budget is actually not big enough to allow us to commission our own work. So we always have to do plays that are already written, or at least that the playwrights might want to do again. So I read a lot of plays and I look at two things: good messages. So we're doing positive role models for children, books that people might know and want to know more. So some titles maybe that are not necessarily popular, but are well known to teachers especially. And then I try to pick three plays that are geared for different ages. So we want to make sure that the 3 to 5 year olds have something for them, and then the older kids have something for them as well.
And typically your runs last for how long? Are you during the week or on weekends? When are your performances?
Right. We do 9 performances a week. So six of those performances are during the week in the mornings for school groups, for field trips. And then three of the performances are on the weekends for family audiences.
Great. Marie, thank you so much. Oh, Freedom is coming to the Lewis Family Playhouse. It's located in Victoria Gardens. It'll run January 27th through February 11th. If our listeners would like more information or to get tickets, where do they go?
They can go to lewisfamilyplayhouse.com.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Lillian Vasquez in conversation with Murray Heppner with the Lewis Family Playhouse in Rancho Cucamonga. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. We are streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Later in the program, we'll hear from Meredith Oakes about her recent book, Rock and Roll Woman, The 50 Fiercest Female Rockers. First, though, let's talk about beer. Emmanuel Rogers has more.
Joining us now is our guest, Ben Robinson. Ben is here to talk about hacking. That's beer, not computers. Ben is editor-in-chief of The Observer and has written for a host of magazines. But now Ben is here to talk about his new book, Beer Hacks, 100 Tips, Tricks, and Projects. Thank you for joining us, Ben.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I'm glad to have you here today because I get to talk about things that are less serious than I sometimes do, but just as serious to a lot of people. So, Ben, what led you to write this completely concise book about beer and the many things that can be done with it?
Yeah, well, obviously, love this stuff, and I think that's essential for somebody who's going to spend a bunch of time writing a book like this. But yeah, if you go back, I think I could see the genesis of this really being in college, where you would often run into the problem of having a beer and wanting to drink it, but not having a bottle opener. And so I learned from a friend how to use the trick of employing a Bic lighter with a little bit of technique to pop off the bottle cap. And, you know, that kind of sat in my head over the years. I figured out some ways to get warm beers cold quickly, just out of necessity. And, you know, kind of started adding to the list in my head, and definitely didn't have all 100 when I started out writing the book.
Okay.
But it was really, really fun project to round them all up.
Okay, now I was actually going to get to the bottle opening later, but let's go for it, man, because this is one of the hacks that I am familiar with, but I would never try it unless I was on the moon because I always thought that this would be followed by a horrible flaming death simply because I wouldn't use the beer to put me out. What other bottle opening tricks do you have?
The lighter is definitely a gimme. You can use your wedding ring or really any ring in a similar fashion, although you do want to be careful with gold because it is a pretty soft metal and it can scuff easily, and then, you know, somebody's going to find out later. You can use a door jam. I've opened and included in the book how to open a beer with another beer, you know, which is a complete paradox, but a very fun one to do. You got to be a little careful with that one so they don't both open at the same time and
right.
One's upside down. And then one of the more fun ones is, it's also a bit of a bar bet, and you say, well, I bet you that I can open that beer with a piece of paper, and nobody believes you, of course. And then you fold the paper about six or seven times, get it really small and stiff, and then you use it much like the lighter trick, and then somebody owes you a beer in the end.
All right. That always sounds good. We should discuss, what is a beer hack?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a lot of different kind of hacks in the book. You know, on the cover, it's tips and tricks, but I think it's shortcuts and really a little bit of information that makes you a better, happier, more efficient and effective beer drinker. And there's definitely a range, but I think they all fall under the hack umbrella.
You know, recently, I don't usually bring up political stuff or anything else when I talk to people because it's just not worth it. But recently, I heard a gentleman say, I like beer. Boys and girls like beer. So, Ben, I'm not going to assume, I'm going to ask, do you like beer?
I'm not 100% sure who you're talking about.
Yeah, let's leave that.
But I also like beer in moderation the majority of the time. But, yeah, I enjoy all different styles of beer, different flavors, and really exploring that world. And I think that there's so much that's happened in the States. Obviously, there's amazing Belgian beers and German beers, but, you know, you can get phenomenal beers from Japan and Italy and places that you might never think of. Brazil has a really, really thriving startup craft beer scene, which is very, very cool. And I think a lot of people are excited about it for a lot of reasons, and it's definitely something that can be a fun passion if you do it right.
All right. Now, I am so curious about this because you did mention beers with flavors. And I guess I'm just one of those dull people because I'm thinking, why on earth would I take a perfectly good beer and infuse it with stuff?
Great question. Maybe you're bored. maybe you're writing a book about beer hacks. But yeah, that was one of my favorite chapters to put together as well and required exhaustive testing, not all of which went perfectly, but I guess that's why you test. But it's actually very simple. You just get a beer, you get whatever ingredients that have really appealing flavors that you want your beer to taste like, and throw it all in a French press that you would make coffee with and let it sit. My favorite that I thought came out really well was getting a big, heavy, dark stout and putting marshmallows, graham crackers, and Hershey's chocolate bar in there, letting it sit for about 20 minutes, and you've got yourself a s'mores stout at the end, which, if you do it correctly for the right amount of time, actually tastes every bit as good as it sounds. And
wow.
That was a hit with the tasting panel, which was my family over Christmas. They said, this, okay. Put it in the book.
I was really wondering about that one, too. All right.
You got to test this stuff.
Did you have a pretty big testing audience with you?
I did, and a lot of them I tested by myself and trying not to set my kitchen on fire.
Okay.
But, yeah, for, like, when we were doing the French Fresh infusions, yeah, I got a whole bunch of people together, and we sampled stuff, and everybody was very honest about the ones that went wrong, and, you know, you could see the look on their faces when it went right to know that you nailed it.
Ah.
But just in talking to people and trying to figure out how to get to 100 of these things, I think that everybody's got something that they've learned over the years and maybe didn't even realize that they had this unique knowledge, passed it along, and that's where so many of them came from.
Yeah, I actually tried some of the opening hacks on so many different things around the house and found out, okay, I can't drink this after I opened it. There might be some glass issues.
Careful.
But no, it was fun still. It was fun because I did succeed sometimes and was able to enjoy what I got there. So it was like
sometimes is first step on the road to all the time.
Yeah, you know, and then there's always, you included this wonderful bottle opener with the book, so I wasn't really in too much danger there. Now, will you take just a moment, Ben, to share with our audience where they can find out more about your book and also what you do as far as a writer?
As a writer, you know, my career used to be more writing, and these days is definitely more editing, but my day job is editor-in-chief of The Observer, which used to be the New York Observer. Before that, I was working at an outlet called Thrillist, which covered a lot of food, a lot of beer, and wrote as much as I possibly could and, you know, tried to make it about beer whenever possible, for sure.
Okay. Now, is it really true that beer can be one of the only liquids that is safe to drink after a nuclear strike?
So this is one that didn't know going into writing the book, but in the course of my research, I discovered that in the 50s, the U.S. government ran a bunch of tests to see how nuclear blasts would affect packaged beverages, and they found that beer bottles and cans that were placed in close proximity to a blast survived intact, which is impressive,
yeah,
and were, quote, well within the permissible limits for emergency use. And I know that if, you know, there's a nuclear holocaust, I'm certainly going to want a beer, so it's good to know that they'd be safe to drink.
I think that would have been the big emergency. I need a beer right here now.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, you speak about this thing that could only come from the dark web or from friends who live in different cities, states, or countries. Why should I trade beer with others?
Well, I think it's all about gaining access to beers that you couldn't otherwise get your hands on. And there's so many great, really local craft breweries around the country, but they don't have wide distribution, so you're not going to be able to get some of their stuff on your grocery store or beer store shelf. But if you have beers near you that other people somewhere else are really interested in, you can, you know, find a friend who lives somewhere with a great beer scene, or just, you know, find some random person on the internet who's looking for what you've got. You line it up. You want to put them in Ziploc bags for the most part, put it in a padded box to make sure nothing goes wrong, yeah, ship them off, and then a few days later you get a present in the mail, and, you know,
okay,
throw them in the fridge or hit them with that fire extinguisher to get them cold in 30 seconds. And and you're rolling, and you can just try new stuff that you wouldn't otherwise get the opportunity to.
Okay, well, that brings a little more comfort to mind, because I was noticing there's no mention about Beer Pal or some way to verify what I'm getting here. So that's a big help.
Hopefully there's a lot of trust in the in the beer aficionado community. Everybody's just, trying to help each other out.
Yeah, now, as our time is running short, I really want to know something about this subject you brought up. You spoke about the premier beer drinkers vacation at the Starkenberger Brewery in Austria. What makes this vacation so special as opposed to going to Milwaukee?
I think that, at least to my knowledge, Milwaukee does not have hot tubs full of beer, which is exactly what you can find at the Starkenberger Brewery. 40,000 gallons of heated beer.
Whoa.
That you can go and just kind of sit and chill in. they claim that it'll heal your wounds and improves your skin. Is that true? Yeah. Why not? I think it is. sitting in a giant tub of hot beer is, I think, a rare treat for the beer lover. And,
right.
When you feel like you've done everything else, you can do that.
Okay. Well, Ben, I want to thank you again for joining us, because Beer Hacks is really a fun book to read and helpful in the most real sense for aficionados of beer everywhere. So thank you again.
Thank you so much for having me on. This is fantastic.
Thank you. It's been fun for me, too. I appreciate you showing up and talking about something, well, that's part of our American culture and sometimes my house.
Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Ben Robinson, author of Beer Hacks, 100 Tips, Tricks, and Projects. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org, I'm David Fleming. Let's go now to a recent conversation I had with Meredith Oakes. You may have heard her on All Things Considered. You may have seen her work at Guitar World or Rolling Stone. She's authored several books as well. And her latest is Rock and Roll Woman, the 50 Fiercest Female Rockers.
All we hear church people say, they are in this holy way. There are strange things happening every day.
This may start with you having to describe what you've been doing professionally for a while, or because I want to know, how did this start? Whether it's a collection of interviews, became a collection of, I don't want to say blogging, but there's nothing wrong with that either. You're a music journalist, among many diverse and eclectic things, it seems. Skipper, for example?
Yes, I'm very proud of my keelboat sailing skills.
Many folks, as they're listening, you've contributed many pieces to All Things Considered and much more. Are some of these pieces that lended themselves to the book? Or, again, how did this really all start coming together?
I have been contributing to NPR for a really long time, although not for the last year or so, because I've been completely consumed by Rock and Roll Woman. But yeah, I've been doing music pieces, commentary, pop culture commentary for NPR for ages, and I've also written for Rolling Stone and Entertainment Weekly, and I was an editor at Guitar World magazine. And I hosted a daily talk show for many years, so I've interviewed everyone. I mean, not just musicians, actors, politicians, athletes, authors, all kinds of interesting people, a lot of people in the food world, chefs and makers of interesting food. But music's a lifelong love, and this book has kind of been floating around in my head for a long time. I wanted to write about women in this way, short essay form, find the narrative threads between their lives and careers. And so the opportunity came up to do it, and I was really happy that it did.
How did the opportunity happen? Were you just sharing with someone this literal wealth of knowledge and all these experiences and pieces that you've contributed? Once they stack up, they're close to being a book. So how did this become a conversation to going toward an actual book, something almost tangible? Well, it is by now.
Yeah, it's just out. Sterling actually wanted to do this book. They wanted to do this project, and they brought it to my agent. My agent brought it to me, and we figured out that this was like a perfect match. And even though I'd have a treasure trove of interviews and things that have never seen the light of day, and some of that made its way in, but most of it is new. It's new research and new talks and new information that I set out to do over about a course of a year. So that's how that happened.
Okay. I mean, I really was sure that this was a collection of your experiences that ended up being a book. So a lot of this actually was new research then for you.
Yeah. It was more like background, all the things I've done. I've worked as a touring musician within my own bands and other people's bands. All the interviews I did and all the writing and editing I did for Guitar World and various other magazines and the radio stuff. I mean, it's all in there, but it's mostly a prelude. You know, it was mostly background. And you know how it is. When you love music, you amass a ridiculous amount of trivia in your head, and it just stays there.
Yeah.
Like, kind of, you know, until there's a place to put it. So some of that is that. But, yeah, most of it was like this brand new project. I mean, there hasn't been a book like this in about 20 years.
Reach back to 20 years. What are you thinking of elsewhere that was out there before, you think?
Well, there was that Rolling Stone compendium of women in rock.
Okay.
There was Rock, She Wrote. I mean, there were some, and the 90s was, you know, the decade of Riot Girl, and I was asked to write the same Angry Woman article over and over, and there were a lot of things going on with women in rock in the 90s, but when the decade ended, girl power was considered the Spice Girls, and Britney Spears was at the top of the chart with her, you know, midriff and her schoolgirl outfit, so it was a weird decade for it to end the way it did.
In this book, we have folks from, gosh, my grandfather's age to born about the time I was getting out of the Navy. That means that I'm the perfect age for folks like the Runaways, Joan Jett and Lita Ford, Susie Sue, Tina Turner and Deborah Harry and all that. When you were putting this together, I am curious about the process that it took in that did you decide on a person or as you were reading about one group and then you find out, well, their influences were this group, so you go working backwards. What kind of a process did it take once you were deciding who you wanted to include?
Well, I mean, the process of narrowing it down to 50 was actually excruciating. I mean, that was painful. And I worked with my editors at Sterling, and everybody had ideas, and we all were fighting for who we cared about and who we really felt made an impact on rock and roll. There's so many great female artists, but you wouldn't necessarily say their major impact was on rock. And so we tried to narrow it down to that. But the two who I knew, and I knew exactly where they were going. I knew I was going to start with Sister Rosetta Tharpe and end with Brittany Howard of the Alabama Shakes. So, you know, the rest we hammered out over a period of weeks and months. I mean, it took a long time.
So what was the significance of using those two, and not only including those two, you know, the at least Sister Rosetta Tharpe, the reason that she is there, that is clear to some, but the fact that you chose to bookend with these two. Talk about this significance, then.
I really did start there, knowing the beginning and the end, which is not a bad way to start a book. I mean, if you have an intro and an outro, sometimes those are the hardest things to do. But to me, those two artists in particular make this really beautiful arc, this connection between gospel and blues, the North and the South, and the Great Migration, and things that are going on now culturally, musically. And also because Brittany Howard really practically channels Rosetta Tharpe sometimes. She plays the same guitar as Rosetta oftentimes. She casts her gaze to the sky like Rosetta did. She wears a cape on stage. They both love to go fishing on their off days. And, you know, but most importantly, they had this deep connection to the building blocks of rock and roll, and that's gospel and blues.
Yeah, nice. At the end of the foreword, there's an interesting statement. At the end of the foreword, you mentioned that it's put together chronologically but can be read randomly, and that's a quote that just grabbed me in and of itself. But it's true, you can just pick this up and just sort of thumb through it, stop and read for a bit, and I really love this part of it. But what made you choose to go in chronological order, say, as opposed to common backgrounds or common genre, something else?
You know, if we went in chronological order, roughly, I mean, not age-wise, but like their period of major impact or when they started recording, I figured it would make sense that way because at the end of each chapter is a little section that says influenced and influences.
Yes.
And a lot of these women influenced each other. And it was that was also a way I could cram more women's names into the book, you know, just couldn't give them a chapter, but I got them into the canon, you know?
Yes.
And so I figured going chronologically made the most sense in terms of that, because as you're reading along, you see Marianne Faithfull, and then underneath, I think I put maybe Gwen Stefani or Lady Gaga, I don't know, someone. But then, you know, whoever was underneath was perhaps going to be later in the book. So I kind of wanted it to go back and forth. But the whole idea of having this book where you could open at any chapter First of it's a tribute to my own Gen X sort of ADD.
Sure, yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. But then the other part of it is I'd love to think about music as this timeline upon which you travel during your entire life. You know, you may start with, like, The Replacements, and then you hear Paul Westerberg talk about Alex Chilton, and that's how you discover Big Star, and then you discover all this obscure New Orleans soul through Alex Chilton, and then you go just back and forth forever, learning stuff and finding new things to listen to and new inspiration.
When you were describing this, this is something that I've pointed out to everybody that I've shown this book to. I've pointed out the fact that not only do we see the influences, that's cool, we get that often, but you have it directly influences and then influenced. And so just as you were describing it, I almost heard it as sort of a clickable, as if we were online, you could click that name and go back to it or forward to it. You mentioned that some of the people that you ended up including, I think this is connected. I really greatly appreciate the fact that you're not just going with, say, female-led bands that people would know. We would know a lot of those names, but you're touching on female members of bands. Folks may not know the name of the person in many cases, but they would definitely know the name of the band. Was that ever a consideration? It's like, you know, to name somebody that a person wouldn't know. You know, say like, gosh, I'm thinking Cyndi Lauper and Chrissie Hynde and all these folks, people know their names, but I'm trying to think of someone that is just part of the band where they know the name much better.
Tina Weymouth. Talking Heads has the album, the name of the band is Talking Heads. And
Oh, yeah.
How many people know Tina Weymouth's name?
That's funny, I just mentioned
but
that.
Not a lot.
Yeah, that's true. Well, a great example that we stumbled on that one at the same time. So, yeah, was there any hesitation to mention people that other folks may not be aware of, or maybe that's even the driving force behind it? That's all the more reason to put it in.
Yeah, I kind of wanted a mixture because you don't often see a book that combines women who are very, very famous and women who are very, very influential, and then some women who are both.
Yeah.
So I felt like all of these women had a profound impact on music, on culture, on kicking down the doors for other women in all sorts of areas. And they all belong in the same book. I wanted a place where they all could, like, you know, sit together.
Truly. Well, somewhat related that many of the women in here are from very well-known groups, but again, also very much appreciated, you do also include groups like, say, the Slits, the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, Bikini Kills, lesser well-known, but still they're really rock, for lack of a better way of saying it at the moment. I'd love to hear of a group or person, since a lot of this was new research for you. I'd love to hear of a group or person that you didn't know about before tackling the book, and say someone that really took you by surprise, and whether it's their anger, the venom behind their words, the stage presence, something that really grabbed you that you didn't know of before.
Ooh, that's tough because I'm really familiar with all of these artists going in.
How about something new about them that you didn't know?
I didn't realize how deeply involved in charity work Annie Lennox was. I knew that she did good things all around the world, but I didn't realize the extent of her dedication and the fact that she has her own NGO, The Circle, and she does things like go to towns in Pakistan where women aren't allowed to work and buys them a fleet of cabs, and now they're making money. The poverty she saw while touring impacted her so profoundly that she decided she had to use her celebrity to do something about it, and not just to give money, but also to give time and effort and really try to change things. So I guess that kind of was a surprise, and a beautiful surprise, to know how much she does for, you know, less fortunate women all around the world.
Truly. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Meredith Oakes. Her latest book is Rock and Roll Woman, The 50 Fiercest Female Rockers. You mentioned just a little bit ago, when you were starting this, the first names that you knew that you had to not only include but to bookend, Sister Rosetta Tharpe and also Brittany Howard of the Alabama Shakes. So what were some of the other names that you just knew that you had to include? Again, you had to have been cutting so many. I'll be asking about those a little bit later, I suppose, but yeah.
Well, I mean, there were obvious choices. Grace Slick, right? I mean, such a powerhouse of a human being. I mean, an amazing woman and a great performer and a fascinating life. Janis Joplin, had to put her in. I mean, rock and roll legend and interesting stories about her that before she died, she had been kind of happy. And then she started sort of, all these dark things started happening around her. Yeah, and then, you know, there were people I wanted to put in, like Linda Ronstadt. To me, people might say, well, she's not so very rock and roll, but she is, and she was. I mean, she had that album where she covered Chuck Berry, and she put the Eagles together. It's her first touring band. I mean, she was so part of the California country rock scene, I couldn't not put her in. Plus, I'm a huge fan.
Oh, sure.
And then I wanted a representation of punk rock. I wanted Wanda Jackson in there because I needed to have a country building block, a rockabilly woman who was so part of the beginning of rock and roll before it even really had a name. Patti Smith, I mean, you know, punk rock poet. I wanted a diverse selection. So a lot of different things went into it, but the basic criteria was, do they rock? Have they had a profound and long-ranging impact on rock and roll? Are they fierce, and what does that even mean? I mean, we talked about that for weeks.
Right.
So that's basically how we narrowed it down.
You know, I completely agree with the Linda Ronstadt, and it doesn't matter whether or not I agree because, you know, it's published. But Carole King, I that's the one that really took me by surprise. If we're looking at 50 fiercest female rockers, that's just a wonderful alliteration right there. But Carole King, she deserves every accolade that she could ever get and then some. But I'm not sure if I ever thought of her as fierce. Yet she has to be included. So did you think of her as a maybe?
Here's the fierce quotient to me with Carole King came after she left L.A. Because, you know, she starts in Brooklyn. I guess she only starts in New York where she's 15 years old.
Yeah.
And she's taking the subway into Midtown and going to the Aldon building and Rill building and pitching her songs to these titans of the industry. I mean, who has the moxie at 15 to walk into a very famous, powerful man's office and say, I wrote these and they're great. Have them, make them recorded, make it happen.
Absolutely.
So that's pretty fierce. The other thing about her is that after she moved out to L.A., she sort of came to represent this back to the earth movement of the 70s, and she moved to rural Idaho, right? What's a nice Jewish girl doing in rural Idaho? I mean, it's like really no running water, no electricity. When the town wanted to use her land for something that she disagreed with, she fought them tooth and nail for years. She was in court for years over it.
Hmm.
And then just recently when they had the Women's March all over the country, she was in her little Idaho town, which has resident 60 residents. 29 of them, including Carole King, were out marching. So I know she doesn't seem fierce, but she does have, like, a lot of fierce in her history.
I'm glad that you included that. That is wonderful.
Me too.
That is fantastic. We were talking about Wanda Jackson and Fanny. I've actually been lucky enough to spend a bit of time with Wanda. Now, this goes back maybe 8 years, so she was older by then. I've also very luckily and very recently interviewed June Millington from, well, now it's Fanny Walks the Earth, but that's when I discovered Fanny. So I'm curious about you with your association with the various Guitar World and Rolling Stone and NPR. When did you first discover Fanny?
Well, it's funny. I knew June Millington through the women's music movement, which she got involved with after Fanny, which was Chris Williamson. And it was like, you know, women's music for women, by women. It was super women-oriented.
We spoke of that period,
so I'd heard of her. And then I knew about Fanny, but I had not heard them. And then a friend of mine who lives in San Francisco kind of got to be friendly with them. And so she introduced me to their music years ago. So Fanny was going in. I mean, they had to be in the book.
Yes, absolutely. This was one of these, you pick up a book like this, and I know you have to be guilty of it too, okay? I'm just going to say this, because people will pick up a book, and if it says the 50 fiercest, you know, the first thing you do is think of somebody. Oh, yeah? Well, what about Tina Turner? Oh, yeah, there she is. Okay. What about Susan, you know, and oh, there she is. So you passed all the, oh, yeah, where is she? Oh, there she is. So you passed on that one big time. Yeah. But there are a couple of more of these questions that actually, they're fed to folks like us, and there is one that did strike me, and what do you think about rock and roll, whether or not it is a more hospitable, that's an interesting word to use there, but hospitable place for female artists than it used to be? I would say that it would have to be, but there are so many factors there. And
I think it's better than it used to be. This new survey that Fender just did, Fender Guitars, that recently came out, that said that about half, 50% of new guitars are bought by young female players. So that's very encouraging to me. When I went in to buy a guitar when I was a teenager, I was the only girl for miles. I mean, you know, no one could even believe there was a woman in the store.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think even, again, as the 90s ended so strangely, and then the aughts began with very sort of young, macho-ish bands like The Strokes and all that, there weren't a lot of rocking girls for a while. The Warped Tour, which is really interesting, it started to sell about half their tickets were bought by women, and yet there were no female artists on the Warped Tour for a while. And that's in the book, too. This woman, Shira, she had a truck that she painted pink and made a stage out of it, and it was called the Shira Girl Stage, and that's where Hayley Williams, who's in the book, and Paramore started. And within like a year or two, they were on the main stage. So I think that over the last 10 years, 15 years, it's gotten a lot better.
Hayley falls into that. She's that category that I mentioned at the beginning of, oh my God, she was born when I came out of the Navy. Looks like she's also came from near where I was from, near Franklin, Tennessee. That's interesting, but it's such a wide, diverse group. And that's something that's really cool, I think, not only for folks that, well, they appreciate a variety, but this is also cool because it will make somebody look at something new. It'll make people look at Pat Benatar and then eventually end up with Avril or Martina McBride or, you know, Alanis or, you know, one of the other groups. You wouldn't think of a connection from Pat Benatar to that. But, well, I want to mention that folks can also find out there Aretha, the Queen of Soul, A Life in Photographs, also Bruce Springsteen, an illustrated biography, and the Bruce Springsteen Vault. Now, that one goes back maybe 17 years or something like that.
That came out in 2015.
Oh.
Actually, the Bruce Springsteen Vault is, I know, Amazon has it wrong.
Yeah, they say 2001.
Like, I've been trying to get a fix for, like, since then, pretty much.
Okay.
So, you know, sometimes they are just not responsive. But yeah, it's a little confusing. But no, that book came out the year before his memoir came out, thankfully. So I got to sell a bunch of books, and then he wrote his own. And then the illustrated Bruce, it's the same book with an extra chapter and new material.
Oh, okay.
So that's a second edition, actually.
Okay, cool. And these are at Amazon.com. But is there also maybe a better website where folks can not only catch your books, but maybe springboard into the other directions? Is there a MeredithOaks.com by chance?
There is a MeredithOaks.com, and that's just sort of a portal to various things that I do and a sort of Tumblr blog that's really just my Instagram. I love Instagram, so that's a great place to find me, just Meredith at MeredithOaks, O-C-H-S, and Twitter. And there's also a Rock and Roll Woman Facebook page that I want the discussion to continue on because I want to know about bands that I haven't heard of. So I'm hoping people will post there and tell me things that inspire them and spread the word about some worthy artists who maybe aren't getting enough press as they should.
Nice. A few more notes. You were the first female editor at Guitar World magazine, and this is looking back. It's definitely an interesting note, but was it at the time, were people looking at you like, you can't do this because you're a woman? Was this significant at that time?
I think it was just like the shock of it at the time, and this was the very late 90s. I mean, this was not like 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, right.
Like 20 years ago. So I would call up some of the contributors or some of the photographers, and I'd be like, I didn't know Guitar World had women editors. I'm like, they do now. But it was also, it was fun for me because forgetting the gender stuff, I'm a guitar player and I love guitar. So to me, I couldn't have thought of a better job.
I would like to see it as such, but you do have it noted there. This may have come from the website that I just asked you if existed. Now, just a couple more things. You mentioned that you are a guitarist. I did enjoy Hey Tonight from the John Fogerty tribute disc.
Oh my God, thank you so much.
Yeah.
We took a chance on slowing that down, which, you know, some people got really angry, but I figure if you're going to do a cover song like that, you need to do it either note for note or put your own spin on it completely.
Yes.
We stretched it out like a Cowboy Junkies song.
Yeah, good way of describing that one. You gave proper tribute, yet at the same time made it your own. How did it even come about, you being a part of a John Fogerty tribute disc? Was that something you were asked to do, or you had the song and somebody putting together the compilation grabbed it? How did that involvement come?
I've been in a lot of bands and, you know, toured in other people's bands and had my own band. And one of my own bands was called The Damn Lovelies. And we put out a CD called Trouble Creek. And we recorded it. And we had a couple of offers for small indie labels that wanted to sign us. And we went with one called Dren. Remember from Happy Days? You must, because you know
Letters Dren, of Dinero. Yeah.
Remember
Potsy.
When Potsy is a nerd and Joni falls in love with him and starts calling him Dren, which is the opposite
nerd
of nerd.
That's right, nerd backwards. So, that's right.
Very precious. So we went with Dren, which is still out there. They once in a while may put out a record or two. And he gave us a very nice deal, and we had a good working relationship, and we ended up on a few of his compilations, too.
That's really cool. Again, really cool. I would love, but now I just want to be like, oh, well, did Anson Williams ever respond to you? So,
I never sent him one. How dumb.
Oh,
I am seeing Ron Howard in about a week, but.
Oh, well, tell him then. Take Dren, play it backwards, see what happens. Okay. Two more things real quick then. I noticed that also it's listed your contributor to the upcoming Women Walk the Line about female country stars. Is this a documentary? Is this a book? What is this?
Actually, it's a book, and it's been out for a while.
Oh.
It is a collection of women writers writing about women country artists who have affected them, moved them, inspired them in some way. And it won a Belmont Award. It's a really beautiful book. It's edited by Holly Gleason, who is an incredible, like just a multi-talented. She wrote a couple of hits for Kenny Chesney, and she's also a publicist, and she's a journalist. She's done it all. And so she put together a book, and Roseanne Cash wrote a chapter about her stepmom. Taylor Swift wrote a chapter. I guess they took an essay that she wrote when she was about 17 and published it. There's a lot of really great writers in that, and I was so proud to be included. And I wrote about Bobby Gentry, who was
wonderful. Yeah.
Kind of my portal into Southern culture as a kid.
Wow. So one more thing then on Rock and Roll Woman, there had to have been folk that were in the running but weren't included. I mean, you could only do 50 unless it became something weird like the 53 most significant, and that's just an odd number to go with.
Like the 1,000. I mean, there were so many.
Oh, yeah? Who's the biggest shocker? If somebody, the most often you've heard maybe, why wasn't so-and-so included? Have you gotten any of those enough?
I thought I was going to get a lot more, so I'm really relieved so far that it hasn't been that bad. Because, I mean, come on, the internet is comprised of people
cruel.
Who make lists and people who trash those lists. So
yes.
I really was expecting a lot of blowback. But a couple of names that have been mentioned, Lady Gaga, who is amazing, but rock and roll, I don't think that's where her main influence is. Today, someone suggested Sarah McLachlan, which I guess, I don't know. Again, she doesn't really rock. She's great. She's a great songwriter. I'm a fan.
Sure.
And she did great things in the 90s with Lilith Tour, but not exactly fierce rock and roller.
Nice. Okay. Could there be a part two, or are you just done with this? Are you ready to wash your hands of it by now?
I'm done. No, I hope there's a part two. I mean, this is a lifelong love for me, so I hope at some point I'll get to write a part two, hopefully with a lot of newer artists who are just sort of bubbling up now, and we'll see which are the ones who stick around and really make an impact.
That's a good way of judging it. See who's still here by the time it's time to write the next one. Okay. That was Meredith Oakes, author of Rock and Roll Woman, the 50 Fiercest Female Rockers. More on Meredith, including several other books in and around the world of music, at meredithoakes.com. That's O-C-H-S. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks once again to Meredith Oakes, Murray Heppner, and Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Ben Robinson. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Sharina Wadd, Jesse Rosales, Benjamin Perper, and KVCR General Manager Keith Birkfeld. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVC Arts programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.